So is this how we start the podcast? Do we start the podcast us talking about the intro and how
beautiful
we're not going to do it?
Yes. Yeah.
I want Brooklyn to introduce me with the corporate voice.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Elixir Roundtable. Today's podcast is brought to you by Andrew. Welcome, Andrew. We thank you very much for the sponsorship.
What are we selling today, Andrew?
Not a whole lot.
Beard cream.
Beard. Yep. We've got a lot of beards here. We're gonna need some cream.
Oh my gosh!
I use the pomade stuff, like the wax. Seems best, but
big fan of beard balm. Beard balm is wonderful.
I guess you Canucks call it that, but. I just call it what it is.
Pomade and balm are different.
The beard cream on an offer with increased shavings.
Say that again, buddy. What?
You don't want to hear it again, Matthew. Increased shavings.
The beard cream was in an offer with increased shavings. So you don't spend
Maybe
as
that's
much.
How we start every podcast episode from now on. We just have Paulo tell us a pun.
Pun champ.
If this were live, we'd be seeing numbers just like shrinking down.
No, this is the people want. You just got to give the people what they want. Yep.
So what do the people want today? What are we talking about? I have some Dockered Academy updates. We've been doing the... Cohort 2 has started. Students have had one full week. So we're on the Friday of the first week.
Nice.
So there's some really exciting stuff going on there. I believe we also would like to talk about some ECSX stuff with Andrew, some game development stuff in Elixir, which is going to be super fun. Is there anything else that we want to make sure we cover before I jump in?
Yeah, we want Mike to say a word on this podcast. If you just say it now, it's fine. Just get it out now.
All right, here's a word.
A word, thank you. To make the end roll credits, you have to say at least one word and participate.
I know we're cutting the intro, but maybe we do an outro. We get right. Mike to do some outro to make sure that... Hi, I'm Mike. You've been listening to the Elixir Roundtable.
And we always record this, listeners, we always record this Friday afternoon. So, you know, after a good long week, it's fun to laugh. But back to you, Brookman.
Sure. So I would love to get some folks' thoughts on one of the big challenges for this new cohort. So this is the second Dockered Academy cohort. And what I'm discovering is that every cohort is a different group of individuals. And that sounds obvious, right? Everyone's different people. But different cohorts are going to have different challenges. So it gives us this opportunity to find areas of the curriculum that weren't a good fit for certain people. One of the biggest differences I'm noticing about this cohort, and I don't know why, is that we have a much more varied set of students. We have people who have absolutely like no programming background, that are coming from, this is their very first experience programming and really working in depth with technology, which is really fantastic. That's exactly who the Academy is kind of designed for and hopes to help enter into the Elixir industry. On the opposite end of the spectrum, we also have more people this time around who are more experienced developers. They've already been programming for years. And they have a lot of that technical background. They already have programming experience. Many of them even already have some Elixir experience. And so one of the things that I've been struggling with and coming up with solutions for is how do we help and make a course that can accommodate both the brand new developer who you don't want to alienate, you don't want to overwhelm, and the more experienced developer who you don't want to you know, have be disinterested, make them bored. The, I think, classical education answer is, well, just set a pace for the course and ignore the needs of the individual. I'm obviously not a big fan of that answer. I think that serves no one. So I would love to talk about how do you create a course that can accommodate a wide variety of students. I'd love to get people's thoughts on that.
Like stretch goal kind of things. Like, so you have like a particular task that you're going to do, and maybe it's simple, but then there's an extended task that like someone who might want to go above and beyond because they're more experienced could work on.
And Mike, you had something you wanted to say as well? Oh, you're on mute.
Yeah, how's that? Good. All right. I was like to take a step back first and confirm before how should Dockyard Academy cater equally to both of those groups? Is it a good goal? Is it going to make problems for either of those such that the end result will be worse if we're catering to both? And the answer may be no, that's fine, it's a good goal, but I think that should be the first thing before how do we do this thing is should we be doing this thing in the first place?
It's a really good question. Initially, our vision had been that this course is for helping new developers enter into Elixir. And we hadn't focused as much on helping developers transition from one career path to another. So I think we did and still do have a primary focus on making sure that it is beginner friendly. In terms of where we lean, it's leaning towards making sure it's a beginner friendly experience. That said, one of the experiences I've had with this cohort that has been a phenomenal learning has been that by having both less experienced people and more experienced people coming in, you get this really phenomenal peer learning environment. And the more experienced developers have this opportunity to go deeper into concepts. Today, we did an exercise called Explain It to Me Like I'm Five. So we took two topics, modules and structs, and we had everyone go around in a circle and give their simple explanation of what those things are. And the more experienced developers, it was a chance for them to solidify something they already understand. We got a really excellent explanation today using it as a lunchbox. So talking about, okay, I have a struct. A struct is like a way of, if you have lunch and you have a bunch of things that you want in your lunch, it's a way of kind of making sure that those things are labeled. Like, you know, you have a lunchbox, you're putting in a juice box. And you might put in some Jell-O and you might label that Jell-O dessert, right? And hey, you want to make sure that your mom always gives you dessert. Well, you can use this struct and make sure that every time you get a lunchbox, it always contains dessert. And so really, really fun way of explaining the concept. You got a really varied way of understanding it. And at the end of it, all of the students' understanding, I think, was more solid than when we first began. So as much as originally I walked in with this intent of, okay, it's a beginner course. One, that's not necessarily the only people we attract, right? I've been getting feedback from the more experienced developers, and so far they're really happy with the experience, right? There has been the feedback of, hey, like, yeah, like this is a little slow for me in terms of I've already covered this stuff, but they've also given the feedback that despite that, they've still learned things. And it's still been valuable for them to revisit things they thought they understood really well, because we tend to go into a great deal of depth on, okay, you understand case, condent, if. Let's talk about the why. Why do we have those control flow structures? What are they useful for? When is one a good choice? And those are often things that, even if you're experienced and you think you really understand that, there's a depth of complexity there and a really good conversation to be had. So I don't know if this really answers the question that you asked, Mike, but I think that there's a way of still keeping in mind our core vision that we want to help new developers enter into Elixir while getting the benefits of having this varied cohort. Because in a sense, we don't get to decide who our students are going to be, right? The people that want to take this course are the people that want to take this course.
Yeah, that's So it sounds like if I'm understanding where things are at now, it sounds like maybe the answer or where what's happening is we're focusing on the new engineer, the ones that are newer to it, and by doing that, we are also benefiting the ones that have been around for longer. They may get less out of it, but by focusing on the newer engineers, if you were to do the opposite and focus on the more seasoned one, it would be a disaster, right? Because you'd have people left in the dust, and those are really like you said, that's the focus of the new engineers. And so it feels like the answer isn't to how do we satisfy both. The answer is continue focusing on the newer engineers, and it will benefit the more experienced ones still.
Mm-hmm. And even if we had less of a diverse set of students, if there was less of a starting gap, I think this is still an important decision to make, even if you have less variation. You still are always going to have a group of individuals, right? And I think I've already said it, I'm not a fan of educational structures that just set a pace, and then if you're behind that pace, sorry, you fail. And if you're ahead of that pace, sorry, you're going to be bored. We're not going to tailor this instruction to you in any way. I'm much more of a fan of educational structures that treat people as individuals, that allow people to go at whatever their pace is. So for example, one of the things I tell the students is that they have the ability to contest anything that they don't want to do. So if a student can prove to me that they understand structs and they look at an exercise and go, I don't want to do this, I don't think this is a good use of my time, that's fine, right? I have no issue with that. One of my, and maybe this comes a little bit from a personal place of being someone who really does not like jumping through hoops. When people tell me I have to jump through a hoop, it builds up a great deal of resentment. So I want to create an educational structure in which people are free to pursue their own interest.
Yeah, I guess to echo Mike's point a little bit, it seems like if you focus on the newer student, like the block of more experienced students being bored, like that seems like an easier block to overcome than focusing on the more experienced students and then the newer ones being left behind. Because like if you're being left behind, then you're kind of like, it's like a big deal. But if you're just kind of bored, like especially with like software engineering, like there's ways you can entertain yourself a little bit, like especially when your curriculum has like fun stuff to do and like extra, you know, like I mentioned, stretch goals. Like I know that you've already incorporated stuff like that into the curriculum to an extent. So, you know, those more experienced developers who might be getting bored, like, yeah, take it to the next level, make a little demo repo that really expands upon this concept and show me that you really know what's going on here. And then you won't be bored.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And yeah, that was something that we tried to bake into the curriculum as much as possible, is having a lot of bonuses. We even have a whole bonus topic section that for certain classes, like when we learned about data structures, we learned the basics of, okay, you have keyword lists, you have maps, tuples, all of these different data structures. And so we cover those in some depth. I had a bonus topic that was, what are the performance and memory characteristics of these data structures? So that goes into way deeper detail on, you know, why is it that when you're prepending in a list, why is that so much more performant? Why is it that updating a tuple is not particularly performant, has a bunch of different benchmarks, uses different syntax, it's much more advanced. So having those kind of side readings to go deeper into the topic that aren't part of the core outcomes. But what I'm discovering is that while we had the intent of that, I think it's still not enough. And so I'm coming up with new ways as this cohort is kind of pushing me to come up with new ways really of making sure that those students remain engaged. So for example, we're starting a new multi-cohort project. So essentially a project that would carry through cohorts that alumni could continue to work on, that some of our beta testers can involve people from the community, having this open source project with a focus on helping new developers. There's a few different ideas for it being floated around. We're actually having our first meeting this Sunday. So nothing is set in stone in terms of what it's going to be. Right now, it's looking like it's going to shape into some kind of junior themed hiring and informational site. So something that would have maybe a job board specifically for junior developers, a list of companies that are interested in hiring juniors, information on how to train juniors effectively. So maybe using something like Nimble Publisher. There's a lot of opportunities for how we could potentially grow that, and it might change its shape dramatically. But something like that gives those students the ability to get into a meatier problem, right? A more real world problem. So if they're really having no trouble keeping pace with the curriculum, they then have this other thing that they can go to. So creating kind of extra opportunities for students to get engaged, I think is going to be kind of a common theme in solving this problem.
Another thought on that is that, so the focus of Docker at Academy is really, so one of the issues with Elixir is that we're senior heavy. There's a lot of people who are deep into the more advanced concepts. And because of that, there's talks and there's sites and there's blog posts on that more advanced thing, realm of Elixir. And if Docker Academy really is focused on those, the newer, like that gap between zero and where that stuff starts, your more advanced students in the class, we as Docker Academy don't necessarily need to be the ones to write that content, right? It could be that, hey, you're excelling in this. Here's some things. Here's exorcism. Here's some great blog posts. Here's some tutorials. And then instead of spending the time, focus the time on catering to those that are advancing, you can use that time to continue to focus on what Docker Academy does best and what it's designed for. To improve the experience for the new engineer and offload that.
Relying on external sources of information is definitely something that we've been doing. I'll often link to some of my favorite articles. Exorcism is great. I've shown that to the students for, hey, you've run out of exercises, but you still want to practice this topic in a bit more depth. Well, here you go. Here's Exorcism. That's a platform that is designed to do that. One of the other things I've been thinking about and considering is either expanding Docker Academy to have some kind of a intermediate level course or advanced level course. I think that's something that has been, talked about. It's not on the roadmap in any specific way. The bonus topic section has been one way of pushing the content towards that is, well, let's have some content in there that's for the more advanced learner, that really is not part of the core outcomes of the course, but is really useful and important information as you get deeper into your career. And so potentially splitting Dockyard Academy the Elixir course for Dockyard Academy into maybe a fundamentals of web development, and then maybe something for some more advanced concepts. Because what I found is that 3 months is a really short amount of time. So to cram all the knowledge that we want into students in 3 months, it's a very aggressive way of phrasing it. I apologize. It's difficult, right? It does create a very difficult pace. And so students are really pushed and challenged, and I don't think that we can fit in more advanced stuff into the current curriculum, but to split it out and have some kind of advanced curriculum, I think would be really interesting. On the flip side, one of the things we could do to help support the newer developers that I've seen some boot camps do to success is have some kind of a prerequisites course, is maybe a shorter 2 week, 4 week, the time duration isn't the important part, but have some sort of primer for the course, whether that's a self-led personal content, whether that is maybe a few week weekend course, or I don't know what shape that would take, but having some kind of a prerequisites to make sure that the students are starting with some kind of a base of knowledge. And then you have a little bit more of a level playing field in terms of where people are starting. Again, people are individuals. You're always going to have differences in background. And so we still need to treat them like the individuals, but that could help some of those newer developers who, really haven't worked much with computers and tech before. So expecting them to pick things up at the pace we set is, it's difficult. It's honestly really difficult.
I'd be curious if some of the more experienced developers who have been in object-oriented languages for so long actually might have a more difficult time adapting to the Elixir style of, like, you know, how to use case instead of if, how to not be specifically like breaking for loops and how guards work and stuff like mm-hmm. that. If someone has no programming experience, they're just going to take what you say at face value, like, oh, this is how it works. But then someone else might be constantly trying to shoehorn their already existing architectural philosophy into Elixir and then getting frustrated that you just can't do that for some reason.
All the time. Yes. That's one of the biggest hurdles when you're coming from object oriented. And I think I'm allowed to say this as someone who came from object oriented, so I can appreciate that struggle. I know how to do this in language X. Why can't I just do that here? I've already seen someone do an enum.each and then try to rebind a variable above it. Like kind of replicating a for loop or a while loop that mutates some variable, thinking about things in terms of input and output, as opposed to, well, I have a value, let's mutate it into the shape that I want. It is definitely a hurdle to overcome those mental models. That's what the more experienced developer coming from an object-oriented background is going to experience. So we do spend a lot of time talking about things like, okay, we don't have inheritance. That was actually a question that came up today. Like, hey, how do we do inheritance in Elixir? It's like, well, you know, we don't really do it the way that you're thinking about it. We do have some things called behaviors that we'll go into later on. But that is no longer a paradigm that we use. And so, yeah, it requires completely tearing down your mental models of things. And learning a new way of doing something. So it absolutely is very fun for me. I really enjoy that aspect. Maybe there's something of a rules lawyer inside of me. Folks know I play Dungeons and Dragons. We have a thing called a rules lawyer, which is basically someone who's incredibly nitpicky on the rules. So I'm known for gently correcting language, like when we start using words like assignment or the object, or I will say, no, we say we bind the variable, that is a map, not an object. And so trying to correct those habits, because it's really hard to get out of that muscle memory.
There's one thing that I'd like to add to that, and it's that when you're first learning programming, you have like this maths background from school or whatever. And this, the functional programming is a lot closer to that than object orientation is. And it, when you first learn object-oriented programming, to then learn functional programming, you have to tear down twice instead of going directly to functional and like adapting some things. And the most basic example that I always use is that like 10 years ago when I was starting to learn programming by myself, I remember getting stuck on x equals x plus 1. Just because I had no tutor and I was learning by myself from the internet and having just high school maths as my background, x equals x plus 1 doesn't make any sense. And so that's the flip side of going directly from 0 to Elixir instead of going around via object orientation.
I completely agree. That has matched my experience as an educator. I find having attempted to teach people object-oriented in the past, and now having this experience teaching functional programming, I feel like functional programming just makes more intuitive sense to people. Definitely if they come from a math background, that can be a huge help. But even just in the way of seeing the world, right? In the world, data and behavior is not coupled, right? The way that we have that in object-oriented. If you have something like running, right? You have a bunch of different things that run. You have a cat runs, a horse runs, a person runs, and all of this has some kind of class hierarchy of, okay, well, it's all part of the animal class because animals all run. And it's like, well, wait a second. No, that's not true. Because not all animals run, we might call it different behaviors. It's you know, it's just not the way the real world works. Whereas with functional, when you just say, okay, I have data, here is a horse, and there is some kind of common behavior, let's say movement, running, whatever you want to call it, and I can say, okay, well, here's my data. I'm going to run with that data, and then the horse will move the way that it moves to accomplish that goal. That seems to just make more sense when you split up the concepts of data and behavior, as opposed to coupling them together. It seems to model the real world in a more accurate way for a lot of cases. I know we are running close on time, and would like to talk a bit about ECSX. So maybe that's a good transition point, Andrew, if you want to introduce the topic.
Yeah. So, one thing that I've been thinking about for a couple years, like due to personal interest, but also just thinking about the Elixir ecosystem as a whole and like what kind of things we can do to grow that is game development in Elixir. And I guess I started with thinking about some of the roadblocks of game development in Elixir, some of the things that people, like the, some excuses that people were using as to why, in their eyes, Elixir wasn't a good fit for game development. And then trying to find an architectural style that would work around that and actually conform to what we would hope to see from successful performant games in Elixir. And so one thing that I found was that a big complaint with the Beam in general is that when you're going to update something like a field in a character struct or something like that, like what you're going to end up with is having to pass the character struct in a message from one process to another. And due to the immutability in functional languages in general, like you're going to be making copies of that character struct. And even just the mere fact of passing it from one process to another is also a copy from one process heap to another. So the copying of data, particularly more data than you're actually updating, like if you want to update the hit points of a character, like copying the whole character struct, like does become really problematic, especially as the game grows and the structs that you're using get rather large. So I kind of stumbled upon an architectural style called Entity Component System, or ECS, which seems to mitigate a lot of that particular issue due to its storing the individual characteristics or attributes that make up a character separately. So instead of having a character struct with 100 fields, like what you have then is 100 components, and they're all linked back to the character, which in this case, the character doesn't really exist. The character is more like a metaphysical thing. It's just an ID. That's it. And so all of the things that make up that character, its hit points, its skills that it can use, its strength and dexterity, whatever, all of those kinds of things, like they then become individual components. And that's what your application actually stores, are those individual attributes. So when it comes time to update someone's hit points, all you need to update is the hit point component. And nothing else is touched, nothing else is copied. You're working with the smallest fragments of data possible. And you're also able to use these components to really separate the logic of your systems, your game logic, in a way that is not only performant, but also helpful for development, like the developer experience and development speed, in that if you have, let's say, hit points, what do hit points do? Like, what game logic is actually going to be operating on hit points? Usually it's going to be when you take damage from something or when you get healed, right? So you can then have a particular, you can segment your game logic in a similar way. So you have a game system that says that's going to check for if an attack is being made against your character. And if so, then it's going to fetch only the hit points and, you know, maybe your armor rating or something like that, if it's mitigating damage. And basically that system is going to fetch the bare minimum of data that is necessary to run that logic. And so the damage system is just going to fetch the hit points and the armor, and then you take the damage. The healing system is just going to fetch your hit points or wisdom score or whatever, and then update just those components. So you're not only segmenting the data itself, but you're also segmenting the logic in a way where your game features are, they're not all kind of intermingled together with each other. Like, they're very cleanly separated. Like, if you want to add a new feature of, okay, well, here you can, you know, have some teleportation. Like, you just add the teleportation system. You, if a new component is necessary for that, you add a component to store that data. And then the system, the new system and the new component are just going to be interacting with each other, maybe not even having to have any context about the other features that are unrelated. So in this way, like, you can, especially if you're on a team, have development not just fast, but also with a real clean kind of developer experience. And this has been my experience when building my own kind of demo games with it as well. And so I was kind of trying to think of the best way to get more Elixir developers and maybe even non-Elixir developers into this kind of architectural style and show them that, hey, you can, there are ways to build games in Elixir. And so my answer was to build a framework that makes it as easy as possible to jump right into this paradigm. So concepts that we use in other Elixir frameworks like generators, like to create a new system or to create a new component, is literally just a one-line generator. You type into your terminal and it's going to add the file that you need. It's going to automatically hook your file into the server. So let's say you've got your system logic, it's automatically going to get run regularly every game tick for you without even having to really know all of the internals about how gen servers work or know how to store components in ets tables for constant time lookup. Like, all of that kind of stuff can get abstracted away and you can just focus on building your game features. And so what I've found is you're able to bootstrap your game with ECSX, my game development framework, extremely quickly. And then even once you have that game up and running, like, adding a new feature to it is also like a real quick kind of isolated process. And so, yeah, that's just been what I've been working on lately and trying to flesh it out for performance and for developer experience, for the best, most convenient way to build performant games in Elixir right now.
Those generators are super exciting. I didn't know you'd added generators since I had a chance to have a look. And I do have to ask if that was motivated by my experience at all, because I know that I horrendously misused the framework when I first started playing around with it, trying to figure it out. And you mentioned that had compelled you to want to increase and improve kind of the education pieces around it. So that's really, really exciting. I think that's going to go a long way to helping people understand how to use the framework.
Yeah, one of the benefits I see to Elixir in general is the developer experience. So a big focus for my framework is to try to find the happy path and not only guide the developer onto the happy path, but make sure that they stay on that happy path throughout their development cycle to produce a performant game that's easy to maintain. And yeah, the generators is like, you know, when I'm building a game and it's like, okay, I need to add a new component for, you know, a poisoning debuff or something like that. Like, it's literally just one line. It's mix ECSX gen component, and then the name of the component and the type of the component, and it's ready to use. The API is there. I can begin to directly add more of those components into the game, query those components, update them with just one line, and never having, not even a line of Elixir. You know, you don't even have to go into a file and type out Elixir code or know how it works. You're getting a real convenient API right off of that generator that you can then start using. And so really the Elixir that the developer is writing is their game logic. They're going to be writing the most code in the system. So when they generate a system, it's going to create a, you know, a blank file with an empty function in it. And they just type their desired logic that they want to run every tick in that function. And ECSX takes care of the rest. That's another thing, is really thinking of your game in terms of what should happen every tick. You know, like, what changed between the last game tick and this game tick, and that's the logic that you're going to be writing in your systems. And then we have examples for front ends as well. I mean, that's the next step. Like, you're building out your game. This is all back end that we've really been talking about so far, but I've really tried to keep it front end agnostic. Like in our tutorials, we mostly use live view because it is, it seems like an obvious lowest barrier to entry kind of way to get a front end set up on your game. But you could easily bring in some other GUI library, Scenic or something like that, and hook that up to your back end as well. And so right now we have tutorials just for live view, but hopefully down the road we'll have other front-end oriented tutorials for stuff like Scenic or for live view native.
So Activision, Blizzard, you know, if you're listening, go check out the link below to see Andrew's beautiful work. It's cool stuff from the non-engineer here at the round table. You broke that down very well.
I should say that there's more information coming up out on that.
Cool.
Through as far as blog posts. And,
within the next month, probably there will be a blog post coming out on dockyard.com.
Yes, there will. So it's not just for one specific style of game or medium, you know, PC versus PlayStation or Xbox. Is that what I can glean from that long description that you gave?
Well, yeah, as far as styles of games go, like I will say that ECSX and the ECS architecture in general is geared towards real-time games. So okay. Turn-based games don't, you could still create turn-based games in ECS, but the idea of wanting to go from tick to tick and running this logic every tick, like, is really geared towards real-time games and also simulations, any kind of real-time application that you want your changes to be up to the second, up to the millisecond even, like as, you know, to keep up with a frame rate or something like that. We're, you know, being kind of a back-end framework, you will have the possibility of hooking in whatever kind of front end you're used to building. Like we'd like to keep it, like I said, as front end agnostic as possible. Elixir has, until Live View Native, like kind of been more relegated to the web domain. But what we're hoping for with Live View Native is to start breaking into mobile applications and native applications. So those are totally on the table for ECSX games.
Nice.
Well, I have a question about game ticks. Are they like provoked by system clock, or is it like a specific process that generates ticks after however many milliseconds?
Yeah, so the tick rate of your server is something that's configurable, and there is a manager process that's going to follow the tick rate and send messages at that predetermined rate. Like, so it might be every 50 milliseconds. It's using the Beam's clock to run your game systems. They're serialized to prevent race conditions between the individual systems. So that manager is not only going to be in charge of scheduling the ticks, but also scheduling the systems within the tick to ensure that they don't conflict with each other.
Cool.
And that under the hood is Gen Server.
Yeah, because when you mentioned like turn-based things, it got me wondering if maybe people could plug like a manual tick generator where instead of the tick being clock-based, it's based on some event So perhaps the person passes their turn or finishes their turn by pressing a button, and that provokes a tick change. And if the ticks are like counted, you can decide on whose turn is it based on like tick mod 2 for a 2-person game, or like a whole different range of dynamics there.
Right, I could definitely see that as some kind of possibility, you know, a configurable option where the manager isn't going to emit ticks automatically, and instead there's an API exposed where you're going to have to call that function when you're ready for the next tick. So yeah, not something that's currently implemented, but definitely a possibility down the line.
Just throwing that in the air.
Appreciate it, Paulo.
I will have it done in like a week. He just won't sleep. And here you go, Andrew. Add that. Merge that.
It's the strength of Elixir development speed, right?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I could talk for literally hours about ECSX with Andrew. So I think
we can do part two.
Perfect.
And maybe explain how it works within, I don't know, not Modern Warfare, like, I guess, World of Warcraft or something more.
Really reminds me of that old military game. I think Dwarven something. It's like a dwarf manager where you have a civilization, you have a bunch of different features running in parallel. Dwarf Fortress, that's it. I wonder if that game's implemented with this architecture, because it feels like that's the type of game this is designed to build. Is that like constantly running a ton of different systems integrating together, great deals of complexity, and so a lot of moving parts, but you need that ability to like just introduce a new component. Really, really cool. So
I'd love to see if someone make a Dwarf Fortress clone with ECSX. That would be awesome.
Dwarf really cool. Fortress. Now I gotta look it up.
It's really, really cool, Matthew. It's a game. I think it got UI improvements recently as well, so it doesn't look miserable anymore. It's at least a little bit easier to
understand. I don't know, the landing page looks a bit scary.
Yes, it is a scary game.
I can see the allure, though.
Yeah, it's definitely an intimidating game. I've never actually played it. I've just heard and seen how cool it is, but it feels like it's a pretty difficult game to like. Well, maybe I should just try it, but it seems like there's a lot of moving parts. I really want to see someone incorporate ChatGPT and gaming. I think we're on like the cusp of that becoming really popular and common. Imagine being able to generate your dialogue, having truly evolving worlds. I don't know if I've seen it implemented well yet, but I really look forward to that being a thing. Andrew, as always, I love talking about ECSX with you. I look forward to talking about it more because it sounds like there's really... some really exciting developments on the horizon with that. I want to thank everyone who listened to this episode of the Elixir Roundtable. You can find links in the show notes to Andrew's library, ECSX, as well as anything else that we talked about. And that is going to be it for this episode of the Elixir Roundtable. Hope you all have a very good week.